I'm talking today with Jenny Kasam, who is a managing director for Cannabis Law Group based in the Bay Area. Jenny specializes in environmentally friendly and socially responsible ventures, and I'm really pleased to have her here today to help shed some light on what are the legal and the tax structure options for for-profit social enterprises. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So I want to start with a broader perspective, and if you could just go through what are some of the options for businesses who have a social mission but who are not for-profit social enterprises or for-profit 501c, or excuse me, or a nonprofit 501c3.
Well, there are really numerous options for structuring. Sometimes I think people think about the structure, too early in the game. I think it is best to first think about all your other business objectives and then have your structure follow your business objectives. But really, a social enterprise can be any type of form. But sometimes people want to have their form really express what they're all about and also in some way protect their values and mission. Because, for example, if you form a California corporation or a Delaware corporation to run your social venture, there is a legal requirement that you put the interests of the shareholders first. So even though there is a lot of leeway in that, there is always a possibility if you start to get more and more shareholders. Of course, it's unlikely if you just have a few, close friends who are co-owners, but if you start to bring on more investors, there is always the danger that your shareholders could say, when you're following your mission, you're not putting our interests in maximizing our profits first. Mm-hmm. And this is especially the case when someone wants to buy your business. And this is what happened with Ben and Jerry's, which is kind of a famous story. Ben and Jerry's did not want to sell out to a big multinational corporation, Unilever, but they were threatened with shareholder lawsuits who felt, they wanted to maximize their profit. So Ben and Jerry's felt that they had no choice and had to sell out to the big corporation, big multinational corporation. So if that is something that you're concerned about, there are some ways to protect yourself from that. Each state has different laws regarding whether you have to maximize shareholder profit at the expense of other stakeholder interests.
Jenny, let me ask you a basic question. And do these laws, are they governed by, for example, I know lots of companies will be incorporated in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
So are they governed by where you're operating or where you're incorporated or some type of combination?
Generally, it's where you're incorporated.
Okay.
And so in 20 states, let me put it this way, in 30 states, there's a statute that actually is designed to allow the board to consider interests other than just the shareholders' profits. But those states are the states where very few people usually will incorporate.
Mm-hmm.
So, Delaware and California, for example, do not have those statutes. So in those 20 states that don't have the statutes, you really are required to maximize shareholder profit at the expense of other interests. And like I said, there is a lot of leeway in that. It doesn't mean that you can't take other interests into account because you can always make the argument that, using my business judgment, I believe that operating in a way that protects the environment, making a big donation to our local community foundation, treating our workers really well, that ultimately that will lead to more profit for our shareholders. So it's not like every decision has to lead to more profit for the shareholders in the next quarter, but, you do have to sort of justify every decision based on the idea that you're maximizing shareholder profit. So if you happen to be incorporated in one of the states that does require that for corporations, you may want to consider using a different form if you're concerned about that. An LLC actually does not have that requirement because an LLC is considered to be more of a kind of like a partnership where people join maybe with more different objectives than just maximizing profit. There's also the possibility of becoming a B corporation, and you can become a B corporation no matter what form you have. Even though they're called B corporations, actually any type of form can become one. And what
when you say that, you mean any type of legal structure, legal form?
Yes, sorry. So becoming a B corporation isn't really a legal thing. It's actually just going through a certification process, taking a survey to make sure you meet all the requirements. And then if you do and you agree to consider other stakeholder interests other than just the shareholders, then you can call yourself a B corporation. And that kind of sends a message to potential shareholders that you are going to consider interests other than just your shareholders' interests.
So B corporation now is not, it's not a legal status or certification, and correct? If I certify my business as a B corp, is there anything that makes me different in under the eyes of the law than if I had the same business that was not a certified B Corp?
So if you decide to become a certified B Corp and you happen to be in one of those 30 states that allows you to, that legally allows you to consider interests other than the shareholders, and you happen to be a corporation, B Corp will ask you to amend your founding documents to state that you will consider other interests, and they have actual language on their website that they ask you to put in your articles of incorporation and legally amend your articles of incorporation to include that language. But if you're not in one of those states, they just ask you to make it a board resolution stating that if the law ever changes, that you would amend your articles of incorporation. But if you are another type of form, for example, if you're an LLC, they will ask you to put that language into your governing document, like your operating agreement for an LLC. So there is some legal changes that you would make as a B Corp.
Okay. And Jenny, where can we find which states, which are part of the 30 states that allow shareholder considerations? And it's the 30 states that allow for other shareholder considerations that aren't strictly financial. Is that right?
Yeah. And so the B Corp website is incredibly helpful. It's bcorporation.net. And what you can do on their website is type in what state you want to incorporate in and also what form you want to use. And then they will tell you whether that state is a state where they would ask you to amend your articles. It doesn't tell you directly what the statute is in that state, but you can tell because they'll say, oh, if you're in this state, for example, Massachusetts, I know, has a statute that protects boards that consider stakeholders other than shareholders. So if you put Massachusetts corporation, it'll say, to become a B corporation, you need to amend your bylaws and add this language.
Okay.
And then what you might want to do, once you've looked at that, you might want to look at the actual corporate statute in that state and find the actual language, because the language does vary quite a bit. And I wrote something about this. It's on my website where it kind of gives some examples of what some of the statutes say. You know,
that's great.
Yeah. And so they do vary. So you may want to look at that before deciding, you know, how you want to operate your corporation in that state.
And Jenny, what's the link to that? I'll include that in the interview.
Okay. It's katovichlaw.com.
Okay. And then it's on the blog there. Okay, great. I've seen that. link to that.
It might be a little bit buried. It's something I wrote a while back. But then there's even more complication to this. It does get quite complicated because there are so many different forms, and then there's 50 states, not even to mention Washington, D.C. But so now there's been a movement. So there are some states. So, for example, in California, there was a movement to adopt one of those statutes that these 30 states have, that does protect boards from considering stakeholders other than shareholders. And this was defeated in California because there were some very strong interests that didn't want to have that kind of statute in California. But they proposed an alternative, and now this is an alternative that's now has been adopted in Maryland and is being considered in Vermont and California right now and probably some other states. And that is a whole new type of form, and I believe in California it's called the Special Purpose Corporation, and some people also will call it a B Corporation, which kind of adds to the confusion. But this is actually a whole new type of form governed by a whole new statute, where when you choose to when you start a new entity, you can choose to form under this statute. And if you form under that statute, you're explicitly authorized to consider the interests of stakeholders other than just shareholders. And you actually, I know under the California statute, which is hopefully going to be passing this year, you're required to actually list what are those interests that you're going to be considering. And you're also required to do an annual report showing that you are considering those interests. And that, if you do that and you form under that statute, you're actually protected from shareholder lawsuits claiming that you're not maximizing their profit. So I expect that to really be a popular thing once that passes. And it, like I said, it already passed in Maryland. And if you really wanted to form one of those entities now, you could form under the Maryland law regardless of where you're operating.
Okay. So it was interesting. In the beginning, you mentioned that a business has to have it needs to have a plan, it needs to have its goals, and that these will then dictate the structure. And this is probably a very complex question, but what, and maybe we can use that L3C as an example, but I'm wondering then what specifically dictates what type of legal structure a business would want to have?
Well, usually it's a few considerations you would ask yourself about. One is how do I expect – probably the most important, I would say, is how do I expect to get funding for my business? You know, if you just expect to bring in a few people that you know to put capital into your business, or if it's just the active participants in your business that are putting capital in, you may want to consider an LLC type of structure. And, of course, within that, there are some different options, which we can talk about. Because an LLC is a structure that has a lot more flexibility. It's really designed to be kind of small. And there's a lot more flexibility in terms of how you vote, how you distribute profits. However, if you think you're probably going to be bringing in large investors like venture capitalists or angels, or if you think you might someday actually go public and get investor, you know, go out to the public to get investors, generally it's going to be way better to use a corporate form. Most investors prefer that because when you invest in an LLC, if you take an equity interest in an LLC, it's like you're becoming a partner in the business and you have to get a special kind of document each year called the K-1, and all the profits and losses are passed through to you and you have to report them on your personal taxes. And most people prefer not to do that. There are definitely exceptions, but, you know, that's generally the rule, is that if you expect to have a lot of outside investors, that they usually don't like the LLC type of model. Another thing is tax issues. In some ways, a C corporation does not have a good tax treatment. There's something called the double tax, which doesn't always affect every business, but if you expect to make a lot of profit and then pay out dividends to shareholders, those dividends will be subject to a double tax. So they're taxed at the entity level and at the shareholder level. And a lot of people want to avoid that. So that's one reason people use LLCs, because the LLCs are not taxed at the entity level. They're only taxed at the owner level. And then this also is affected quite a bit by state law, because, for example, in California, there's actually a special tax on LLCs that are operating in California, even if you're not formed under California law. And that tax is actually based on gross receipts. So that can actually be a big reason not to form an LLC if you're in California, because if you expect to have large gross receipts, California does not take into account, you know, you can't deduct your expenses. So you could have large gross receipts and very small profits and pay quite a large tax in California. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing you would probably consider is your structure. There are a lot more constraints on how a corporation can be run. You have to have a board. You have to have officers. You have to have regular meetings. Whereas you have to keep meeting minutes. Whereas in an LLC, it's a lot more flexible. You actually don't have to have meetings. You don't have to have a board. You don't have to have officers. Also, you can be a lot more flexible about how you distribute how you allocate profits and losses, how you do distributions, how you do votes. So those are the three main considerations when deciding what type of entity to form.
Okay. All right. That's a helpful overview. So we hear a lot now in the social venture sector about the L3C, which stands for a low profit limited liability company. And basically it's a combination of or being able to combine the financial advantages of an LLC with the social advantages of a nonprofit. So what if who is an L3C for? I mean, what type of business or entrepreneurs would want to look into becoming an L3C? And I know that they're not, that status isn't available in every state either.
Right. I think it's in about 7 states right now, but again, you don't have to form in the state that under the law of the state where you're operating. So there are definitely entities in states other than those states that have formed L3Cs. And the L3C is designed for a business whose primary purpose is actually a charitable or educational purpose, but for whatever reason does not want to form as a nonprofit. It might be that you don't think you would qualify
You have some earned income or
it's an interesting question. You can have earned income as a nonprofit. There's actually quite a few things you can do as a nonprofit, and I could do like a whole hour on what nonprofits can and can't do, but there may be some aspect of what you're doing that might be questionable in terms of that might make it harder for you to convince the IRS to give you tax-exempt status, or it may just be that you actually want to bring in outside investors. That's one of the biggest disadvantages of a nonprofit is there's no way to bring in equity investors into a nonprofit. Whereas with an L3C, you can, and you can actually pay them a return. Another reason is you just don't want to deal with all the regulations that govern nonprofits. So, but really, the main reason to form an L3C is that you have a relationship or a potential relationship with one or more foundations that is looking to make what's called a program-related investment. And so a foundation has several things it can do with its the money that it's required to give away to charitable purposes every year. The most common thing that they do is they'll just make a donation to a nonprofit. But they are also allowed to use that money to make a program-related investment, and they can actually make that in an entity that is not a nonprofit as long as the purpose of that investment is charitable or educational and the investment won't be used for any lobbying or, you know, electioneering. And so a lot of foundations, especially these days with the economy the way it is, a lot of foundations are thinking, would I rather give away my money as a grant or would I rather invest it in something that could actually lead to some kind of a return? And I, at a minimum, I could at least get back the principal, whereas with a grant, I'll never see that money again. So a program-related investment is a really attractive thing for a foundation to make. But they're very hesitant to make them, a lot of them are, because the requirements are so strict that if they make a program-related investment in a for-profit business, there's a fear that the IRS could come back and say, this didn't qualify. We're not allowing this as, you know, counting towards your 5% annual giving requirement. So that's why L3Cs were created, because L3Cs right in the statute, it says that the entity meets all of the requirements that are needed to be met for a foundation to make a program-related investment. So the idea is that a foundation would be much more comfortable making a program-related investment in an L3C than in some other type of for-profit business.
And some of the investments have an interest rate and some don't? Or
A program-related investment could take all kinds of forms. It could be an equity investment. It could be a loan. And to be honest, I don't think it's actually happening very much. I think the Gates Foundation might have made a program-related investment in one L3C, but it's not really taking off yet. And that, I think that's because a lot of foundations are still somewhat risk-averse about making program-related investments, and they're not totally convinced that the IRS would be more accepting of a PRI made in an L3C as opposed to some other type of entity. So it's still kind of a new thing. It's still kind of in the process of being tested. But it is certainly an interesting form. You know, it was designed for a very specific purpose. But if somebody is really interested in doing something that's educational or charitable and their primary purpose is not to make a profit, but they don't want to deal with the hassles of being a nonprofit, this is certainly an interesting option.
So I had always thought that it was formed for socially driven, socially oriented businesses something that was a combination or that had some elements of a nonprofit and some elements of a for-profit. But now it sounds like you're saying that really was formed to be helpful to the foundation to have the potential to make these PRIs.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's both. I mean, it was specifically designed to facilitate PRIs being made to for-profit businesses. But, you know, and that's usually the main reason someone would form an L3C, because they want to attract PRIs. But, I mean, I actually have a client who's an L3C, and they just chose to form as an L3C because, you know, they really liked the message that it sent to be an L3C. I mean, I think it's very, it sends a very good message to say that even though we are not a nonprofit, we're so committed to these charitable and educational purposes that, you know, we've determined that our primary purpose is not to make a profit, but to serve these purposes. And it doesn't mean that even though your purpose isn't to make a profit, if by some chance you end up making a profit, that's okay. It just can't be your primary purpose.
So that's such an interesting question. How do you prove that as a business? I mean, I could see a lot of, some people at least saying, all right, well, you know, on paper we'll say our purpose is to make a difference, not a profit. But really, how is that measured or evidenced?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess that might be what you're asking is probably exactly why a lot of foundations haven't jumped on the bandwagon, because even though it says that in the statute, I'm not exactly sure what the enforcement mechanism would be if somebody started to stray from that. I think the state, like in Vermont, for example, I think the state would have the authority to revoke your status. But, in you know, practically speaking, I'm not sure how they would regulate that. And I have to admit, I'm not an expert in L3Cs. I haven't done much with them or studied the statutes extensively. So there are people who spend all their time working on L3Cs who could probably answer these questions a lot better than me. But I think that is part of the concern about L3Cs, is it's very easy to form under the statute. There's no proof you have to provide before choosing to form under that statute.
Do you think that they're going to become, that they will take off of the structure and become available across more states?
Yeah, I think they probably will. I know California is definitely considering one right now. I think little by little they are starting to gain some more traction. So I think it'll just be a matter of time, and we'll start to see them becoming more popular. And, you know, there are – the number of options is proliferating so much right now, like with this other type of entity that we were talking about before. And then there's so many other options. Like, we haven't even talked about cooperatives, which are another really interesting model. And I, you
Let's
know,
talk about cooperatives a little. I want to, before we finish, I want to come back to B Corp a little bit, because okay. I also know that the firm that you work with is a B Corp. But let's talk about cooperatives. I read an interesting article that you wrote about that, which I can go into in this interview as well.
Yeah. So I've been getting really involved in the cooperative movement. I've been going to I just got back from the National Cooperative Business Association conference, and then like a couple weeks before that, I went to the California Cooperative Conference. It's a really interesting form, and it's kind of not as well known as I wish it were. and part of the reason is they are somewhat complicated. I mean, every state has at least one co-op statute. There are different types of co-ops. The general idea of a co-op is that a group of people get together and form an entity that to meet some need. And so it might be a group of consumers who form a food co-op. It might be a group of producers of some type of product to form like a marketing co-op. Like, for example, a group of people who grow oranges or a group of people who grow almonds or whatever, who all get together to form a marketing co-op. Or they might, maybe they get together to form a processing co-op to process their product. It can also be a group of people who get together to form a business to serve their needs of creating jobs for themselves. So they're a worker co-op. So like in Cleveland, they just formed a really huge laundry co-op. It's a worker co-op, and the main purpose was to create jobs for people in Cleveland. So I think that's part of the reason, you know, that people don't form them more, is they are a little bit confusing, and there's not a lot of people who know much about them. In some states, they're much more popular than others. They're kind of some in agricultural states, there's much more of a tradition for forming co-ops, but now co-ops are forming in all kinds of industries, not just agricultural. I have clients that are software developers who have formed co-ops.
Could you give us an example of just because I think it's so, we do think about food and agriculture and produce, and could you give us an example of a software company or co-op or another industry-based co-op?
Yeah, I mean, you could really form in any industry. I actually have a couple clients who are software developers who formed a co-op. And then I have clients that are truckers that formed a co-op.
So why would the software developers want to form a co-op, and how does that work? Is it a couple of different companies or a couple of sole entrepreneurs?
Yeah, so when you want to form a co-op, you... you choose which state and which statute you're going to form under. And like I said, every state has at least one statute, and they actually are all quite different. But if usually you'll go ahead and form in the state that you're located in, because that's the easiest thing to do. And so, for example, in California, we have a statute called the California Consumer Cooperative Statute. And even though it's called that, there is a provision in there that says you can form any type of co-op under this statute. So the software developers, they're not consumers, they're producers. They are producing a product, but they did go ahead and form under that statute. And so what you do is you create this entity called California Consumer Cooperative, and it's very much like a corporation, but it has special rules associated with it, and that is that every member gets one vote regardless of how much capital they've put in. So, you know, one member might – usually the members will all put in the same amount, but it is possible for members to have different amounts of capital in the company, but they still all get one vote, which is very different from a typical corporation where the more money you put in, the more votes you have. And so then all of the members get to vote on the board. You know, they select the board, and then the board runs the company. And but there are, you know, regular elections where the members can decide who's going to be on the board. Actually, REI, you know, where a lot of us go and buy our like camping equipment, is actually a co-op, a consumer co-op. We actually all have the right to vote on the REI board. We all have one vote. and let's see. And the other interesting thing about co-ops is that there's a tax advantage for co-ops. So I had mentioned earlier that, generally speaking, in a corporation, there's a double tax on dividends. Mm-hmm. But co-ops can avoid the double tax when they pay out dividends to their members. So as long as you pay out the dividends based on their patronage in the co-op, which means like how much they're using the co-op. So, for example, with REI, the dividend you get at the end of the year is based on how much you bought that year. Or, for example, with the software co-op, your dividend is based on how much business you brought to the co-op that year. Or with a worker co-op, it would be based on how many hours you worked. So as long as you pay out dividends based on the patronage of the member in the co-op, the patronage dividend, the money that's paid out as patronage dividends is not taxed to the co-op. It's only taxed to the individual members. So that can be a pretty huge tax advantage. In fact, you don't even have to pay it all out in cash. You could pay as much as 80% out as like an IOU and actually keep the money in the co-op, you know, as a reserve. It still ultimately does belong to the member, but you can keep it in the entity, you know, in the co-op to, as a reserve, or, you know, and then just pay it out to the member in the future. And you still don't have to pay tax on it, although the member does.
And is there protection in numbers in that sense? Is there protection in numbers in that sense? So if these software developers come together, so the advantage is there's the tax advantage that you just mentioned, but there's also the investment advantage, right? The reason they would do it is because they have this cumulative investment?
I mean, a lot of people form co-ops for lots of different reasons. One is they really like the fact that it's a democratic structure. There is also an advantage in terms of bringing in capital, and that is that in most states there is actually an exemption from securities law for co-ops. So a lot of times we haven't even talked about securities law, but when you form an entity and you bring investment into the entity, whether it be in the form of a loan or an equity investment, sometimes you have to do a lot of, almost always you have to do some amount of compliance work to comply with securities laws. But in most states, there is an exemption for co-ops, so it's actually easier to bring in capital from your members without having to worry about doing securities law compliance.
Okay. So I wanted to just go back to B Corps a little, because we talk about them a lot on Cause Capitalism, and you work with them, and you work for one. What's your function as a lawyer in helping a company decide to be one or get certified? I mean, as you mentioned, and as we've heard before in other interviews for Cause Capitalism, that businesses can go to the site and they can take a survey which evaluates their level of sustainability, basically, and either qualifies them or helps them work to achieve B Corp status. So what's the legal relationship to it, and your relationship to companies who are seeking B Corp certification?
Yeah, well, you definitely don't need a lawyer to be a B Corp, to become a B Corp. All you need to do, really, and I don't recommend people necessarily try to do it on their own just using the website, but what I do recommend is just contacting the staff of the corporation, and they will walk you through everything, and they'll tell you everything you need to do, so you really don't need a lawyer. But, you know, if you just – and also I did write something that's up on our website also, I think – yeah, I can't remember. I can send you the link, but that kind of explains the basics of becoming a B Corp and the whole issue of if you're in one of those 30 states versus not in one of those 30 states. But they're pretty good at explaining that stuff as well. So you can easily become a B Corp without a lawyer.
Okay. And so do you counsel companies to do this as a benefit, or do they come to you and say, we want your help with this, or what's your, if you don't need a lawyer to become a B Corp, I'm just curious about what your involvement with companies in this process is then.
Well, I don't actually do a lot specifically with helping companies become B Corps, because I do just tell them, you know, if you want to do it, I would recommend just working with the B Corp staff, and they'll help you do it for free. But, you know, sometimes I will explain the pros and cons, you know, not so much the pros and cons, because I don't think there really are any cons to being a B Corp, except there is a fee that you have to pay. But, you know, if people have questions about it, I'll answer them. But generally, I really don't help people become a B Corp. I just encourage them to go ahead and do it on their own.
Could you talk about some of the legal resources available for social entrepreneurs? Are there ways for social entrepreneurs to get advice in looking at what structure would best allow them to carry out their mission that are priced more reasonably than, you know, I guess a traditional or a regular legal services?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first of all, I definitely recommend getting the RSS feed from my website because, you know, that's what I write about, is legal issues for social entrepreneurs. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of resources out there for these specific issues, but there are some. There's something called Structure Lab, which is created by Criterion Ventures. It's actually something that, it's a workshop that you can attend, and they kind of help you go through all of the different structures. I don't think they get into as much detail as you might get into with a lawyer, but I've never attended one, but from what I understand, they're very good at helping you think about all the different considerations and help you figure out which structure would be best. And then also, I have a colleague named Janelle Orsi, and she and I actually started something called the Sustainable Economies Law Center, precisely because there are so few legal resources for people who want to start social enterprises. So this summer is our first summer where we're going to be having law student interns working on creating all kinds of resources for social entrepreneurs, specifically in the areas of cooperatives, urban agriculture, local currency, housing, and financing issues for social enterprises. So So we're going to be creating guidebooks and bank, you know, kind of resource guides and things like that this summer. So, yeah, so definitely check out sustainableeconomieslawcenter.org. There's not much going on there right now, but after the end of the summer, there should be a lot more going on.
Okay, terrific. So, and Jenny, in inviting you on, I mean, this is, you know, so complex as we've been hearing, as I think we anticipated, but I just wanted to bring you on to kind of get an overview, and it's been helpful for me. And so I think with the overview that you presented in some of the different options and pros and cons, and then integrating the resources that you mentioned that are already out there on your site and the other articles that you've written that I'll link to, and then the forthcoming resources from this summer, you know, I'm hoping to start to be able to provide some light for these social entrepreneurs who are faced with a lot of options. And I know we haven't even talked about different businesses who have nonprofit and for-profit components within the same business, which is a whole other conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of examples these days of for-profit businesses that are partnering with nonprofits in one way or another. So that is a whole other interesting conversation.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap up today?
No, I think I talked about everything I could think of at this time. But yeah, there's definitely, you know, so many different options. You know, all 50 states have different statutes and there are so many different forms, so I definitely recommend doing some careful thinking before choosing a structure.
Okay, great. Jenny, again, thank you for your time and for writing about these topics and really for helping us understand it. As I mentioned before we started the interview, your articles are very accessible and useful, and so I'm really excited to share them with our audience.
Great, thank you so much.
For more interviews about cause capitalism, visit causecapitalism.com.